Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Quite an intro, Super Soul. Thanks. Welcome to the Projection Booth, coming to you on KOW Radio. I'm Mike White. Riding shotgun is Rob St. Mary.
Stick it to the man, daddy-o.
Also along for the ride this week is Colin Gallagher.
Howdy, folks.
This week we're talking about The Vanishing Point, the existential road movie from director Richard C. Serafian. Released in 1971, the film tells the story of Kowalski, a damaged man who tries to use speed, both medicinal and actual process of distance over time, to assuage his personal demons. For the majority of the film, we see Kowalski attempting to go from Denver to San Francisco in 15 hours. Now, according to Google Maps, that's about 1,200 miles, and if I figured out the story problem correctly, that means Kowalski would have to average 80 miles an hour for that entire time. But, like Sammy Hagar, Kowalski cannot drive 55 if he wants to make it in time. That's the conceit, but the details are where Vanishing Point really comes together. Colin, what factors make Vanishing Point relevant to you some 40 years after its initial release?
There's not a ton of things like it from the time when it was made, even though it, you know, does bear some similarities to like Easy Rider and Two Lane Blacktop. But it's at once like a time capsule of, you know, sort of the end of a certain era in Hollywood, the beginning of another one. And it's just a very, very unique movie.
Yeah, I don't think that they could necessarily make something quite like this, even though they tried. And we'll talk about the remake in a little bit here. But the structure of the film is pretty great. I love that it starts at the present time and then flashes back, and then inside of the flashbacks you have more flashbacks, and just that opening of the film where you get Kowalski kind of rushing towards his doom, which really kind of is the entire thrust of the film. You know, we never lose that forward momentum of him going down that highway, and that's just what keeps us going the entire time, because he does make some pit stops, which is bad because he's never going to make it to San Francisco in time if he makes any kind of stops, but meets some very interesting characters. And I think, you know, you could really read a whole lot into what these characters are that he meets on the road. Rob, I think this was you were coming to this one relatively fresh, correct?
Yeah, pretty fresh, actually. It's a film that I had heard about and it's sort of kind of always been out there. And I have to say that I was sort of reintroduced to it as an idea thanks to the Tarantino abortion known as Death Proof that kind of put Vanishing Point back onto my radar. But the thing to me, as you were talking about, is, I mean, it's very minimal. I mean, this movie is very minimal. And, I mean, you have Barry Newman as the lead. And I know him from The Limey, which I absolutely love, which is obviously, you know, like 30 plus years on. But he's sort of flat for us. We can sort of put all of these various things onto him. And like the look of the film, it has this very kind of docudrama, sort of handheld documentary camera work at times. John A. Alonzo, who was DP on this, and he had done a lot of great films in the 70s. And the one thing that I like about the movie, I think you're right, they couldn't really remake this, because that opening, it takes about 8 minutes before he shows up. And there's not a whole hell of a lot that's going on in that early thing. I mean, they're getting the bulldozers, they're, you know, everything's lining up on the road, and you don't really really kind of even understand what the hell's going on for the first, you know, 8 minutes or so. And then he shows up in the car, and it's like there'd be no way you could make a movie with that kind of pacing, that sort of deliberate, slow, methodical pacing. It really helps to set the front end of the film up. And another thing I have to say, obviously being a Detroit born and bred and living guy, is that this is a movie that makes Detroit look badass in terms of the stuff that they used to make. I mean, that Challenger, man, that's a car. They don't make them like that anymore.
No, you're right, because the car is pretty much the only thing that carries over into Death Proof, and it's that whole fetishization of the automobile that we're getting in that. We're not really getting the, you know, the existential feel that we had with Vanishing Point and all the stuff that was going on with it. Just the way that the characters are revealed. I mean, it takes forever for Kowalski to even say a line. Drive, the Ryan Gosling film, reminded me a lot of Vanishing Point, just with that whole minimal approach to it, that, again, he doesn't say a whole lot. The audience who is bringing this stuff to him, or other people projecting stuff onto him. I mean, we've got the authorities who are telling us one story, and then we've got Super Soul, who is the blind DJ played by Cleavon Little, who must have amazing bandwidth on his radio station to be able to stretch all of these miles. I mean, from Colorado all the way over to California, but him kind of making Kowalski into this living legend who's tearing across the desert like a cowboy of old, and him speaking to Kowalski, him talking about Kowalski. I mean, again, that's another person who's kind of putting his thoughts onto who this person is.
Mike, you mentioned him as a cowboy. The way I was introduced to this movie was in a class I was sitting in on at the New School, taught by David Meyer, called The Desperate Horizon, and it was all about American Westerns and road movies. And so it sort of put this, Two Lane Blacktop, Wild Angels alongside My Darling Clementine, The Furies, The Iron Horse. I like to sort of think of this as sort of a modern day Western, and it does fit into a lot of the key themes for the genre in a lot of ways.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because when I look at the film, I mean, I love seeing Cleavon Little in this, and I love seeing John Amos, who is actually uncredited in this as his sound guy, his engineer. But seeing the cops who initially chase after Kowalski, they are the ones that are really wanting to get Kowalski with this. And those guys are played by Paul Kozlow and Robert Donner. And both of those guys, though they have been in just a ton of other stuff, I always think of them as Clint Eastwood actors. I guess just because of the great turns that they give, Paul Kozlow in Joe Kidd and Robert Donner in High Plains Drifter, that when I see these guys, I always think of them in those roles first. Though I do tend to think of Robert Donner as his role in Mork and Mindy first and foremost.
It's interesting that you had brought up Cullen Easy Rider. And looking at the idea of the film against Easy Rider, at least from my take, is that this is sort of a one-man version of Easy Rider. It's not sort of the team. Like, you get the idea in Easy Rider that it's sort of the hippies or the anti-war people versus the system. In this, it's actually a man of the system. You know, we learn through flashbacks he was a cop. He was a soldier. This is a guy who followed the rules and suffered. And that sort of in the end here in this film, it's sort of like his way of just giving them the finger. He was part of that system. And I think that that's the thing that makes the film really interesting to me. It can be seen as a companion piece to Easy Rider in terms of its philosophical bend, but I think it sort of takes it one step higher with the fact of the guy's background.
No, you're totally right. I mean, that's also some of the minimal element, where it's just one man, one machine, just driving straight, and he doesn't have anyone to talk to. He doesn't have people to really bounce ideas off of. And I think so much of the ambiguity of the film that I love, that, you know, makes it have so much meaning, you know, sort of comes from that mysteriousness. Like, you never get too close to him. He never enunciates his ideas or his philosophies, you know, too clearly.
Yeah, though you do get a little bit, and I like that. I do like how they give you just little tastes through those flashbacks, where you get to hear about him and this girl who's very into pot. And then it's funny because then later on he meets this girl on a motorcycle and she's got a picture of him and he's holding up a marijuana cigarette as he's getting kicked off of the police force. So you kind of get his story again kind of being fractured his old life. So you get a little bit from the police as they're talking about him as being, you know, a former soldier, and that he was dishonorably discharged and all of this kind of stuff. And so you know that he's got problems with authority throughout it. And so this putting himself on his own timeline, I mean, I think that he gave himself this challenge to get from Denver to San Francisco in that amount of time. I don't think there was really anything that was pushing him to get there in that time other than, I've got this hot rod car, I can be there, I can do this. You know, it's like Cool Hand Luke saying, I can eat 50 eggs. You know, he knows that he can do this thing. He wants to prove that he can. Talking about Easy Rider and how it compares with this film, really for me, what I would compare Vanishing Point to is what some people have dubbed the anti-Easy Rider, which was Electric Light and Blue. I mean, again, you get those vistas of the desert, and you really get Robert Blake kind of questioning all the roles that are that he's being put in, this whole police procedural and the kind of corruption that he's seeing. It's almost like Kowalski and Johnny Wintergreen were kind of cut from very similar cloths, and it's almost like Kowalski is what John Wintergreen could become.
One thing that you often do, Mike, that I appreciate, because as you know, I'm a functional literate, is that you actually read the screenplay and the books and all the various things that go along with all these movies, is that you took time to actually read the original script. Now, it's my understanding, Vanishing Point, from some of the stuff I read online, and obviously we all know that the internet is never wrong, that the film went into production and then they basically cut the thing in half in terms of its production time. Like, instead of going for 60 days, they had like 30 days, and the money was cut and all these things were cut. And I think that in some way that probably lends itself to the reason why the film is sort of airy and loose in that way, that there are probably scenes and different things that should be in there that would really kind of flesh it out. But since it's not in there, it has this sort of ethereal existentialist bend, because that's what the director had to do, because he didn't have all that time to really get into the script and do the script. So
yeah, I was just going to say, I think the studio was getting ready to kick Zanuck out. I think that plays a big role in terms of what was cut and why, and perhaps why the film didn't get as big as a push as it did, and it kind of became a cult hit. But we can talk about that later.
The screenplay was by Guillermo Cabrera Infante, who is just going under the name G. Kane or Guillermo Kane for this one. And you'd be surprised. I mean, the screenplay is 147 pages, which is crazy for what would eventually be a little less than a 120-minute film, that you've got 147 minutes worth of stuff. But I do have to say that once we get to the point where Kowalski is on the road and he meets the prospector, I would say that everything pretty much stays relatively the same, or at least the structure is very similar. Though the prospector, played by Dean Jagger in the movie, he's collecting snakes out in the desert for this, I don't know, some sort of Pentecostal snake handling troop that's out there in the desert. And in the movie, they don't handle the snakes, and they're saying, you know, oh, it's not about the snakes anymore, it's about the music. In the screenplay, there is a lot of snake handling, and it is this kind of much more mystical kind of thing. And there is some more mysticism that you see in the screenplay, especially with the hitchhiker character towards the end. There is a hitchhiker in the final version of the film, only in the European cut of it, or what they're calling the UK cut.
What are you?
A delivery driver.
You're a Scorpio.
Yeah.
What's your name?
Kowalski.
Kowalski? Kowalski?
Yeah, Kowalski. First, last, and only.
Funny.
Very. Yeah, what's yours?
I'll tell you later.
When we get to Frisco?
Why are you going to San Francisco?
It's home.
Home. You make it sound like a good place. I like you, Kowalski. I like you. I've been waiting for you for a long time. Oh, how I've waited for you.
Yes, since when? Where?
Oh, everywhere. Everywhere and since forever. Patiently. Patiently, that's the only way to wait for somebody.
In the screenplay, it's even more mystical than that. And it's kind of strange, too, because it's not a white girl, but it's an African-American lady, completely bald. And she is talking all about the zodiac and all this kind of stuff. So it kind of, she's much more of a mystic who is showing up, and she won't tell Kowalski his name and or her name until a certain thing happens. And yeah, it's just kind of interesting the way that it changes.
I think everything that was cut made for a much better movie. I thought the screenplay, there was way too much exposition. There was this thing where the writer kept interjecting songs like It Takes Two, because he wanted it to be some sort of didactic, almost like Brechtian melodrama. And I just thought a lot of that was kind of cheesy. Yeah, there's just so much exposition for the scenes, too much dialogue, and you know, a lot of the mysteriousness about the character of Kowalski was just gone, because he comes out and starts saying a little too much about his mission and his past. And I guess I just didn't care for that.
To me, the flashbacks work because it almost reminds me of when I've gone on long car trips by myself. And what I mean by that is, you know, I'm usually on a large amount of speed, much like him, and I usually drive 100 miles an hour. So when I'm on a lot of speed and I'm driving 100 miles an hour, I'm usually thinking about things from my past. You know, when you're on the road in the same thing, especially in the Southwest, it has this tendency from the what we see with the landscape, it has almost this hypnotic quality where you're seeing the same thing over and over again. It becomes kind of dreamlike. And when you're behind the road and there's the hum of the car and all of that, you just get into this like alpha wave state where it's like, I guess maybe you're a little hypnotic, or you're recalling things from your past, or you're thinking over things, or, you know, we don't really know all the particulars as to why he's doing what he's doing, as we know. But maybe this is like, I need to kind of get out of the house. I've got to get away from the people that I'm around. I've got to get out on the road, clear my head, think, and kind of roll over these old ideas, these old things that have been sort of like haunting me on an emotional level. And I think that that's why it kind of works for me, that it cuts in and out between of these various flashbacks, or maybe even at times it almost seems flashbacks within flashbacks, which, you know, me being a big fan of Luis Buñuel, although not as surrealist concept within this film, really works for me in helping push the story forward and bring up some interesting ideas.
There's a weird circular structure to the film. You know, at the very beginning, you know, it shows him driving the white car one way, then there's the freeze frame, and you see the black car that he's driving a few days before, and they're there at the same moment. So it's as almost as if, you know, it's almost like a perpetual loop.
I mean, it's almost like the authorities are giving him an out. I wonder how many times he's made this particular trip and thought about these exact same things and met the different people who maybe bring up different ideas as he's going along, because there are some characters that he meets that immediately trigger ideas for him, bring back memories for him. But I wonder if he is kind of caught in this loop, if it is kind of a, you know, roadrunner or coyote kind of thing where he'll never catch that roadrunner. And the end of the film kind of gives him that out, finally.
It seems like all Westerns seem to have this one idea, which is that someone wants to go from point A to point B, really because they want to start over, they want to, you know, find out who they are, they want to become someone different. It's all this process of, you know, self-identification. There are those where, you know, they're able to conquer the land, they're able to start over, to get a new life, and it's all happy and blah, blah, blah. And then there's the other type, which I think, you know, this fits into, where they discover that, you know, they're not able to, you know, start over. They're not able to figure out who they are. Or if they do realize who they are, they really don't like themselves. That sort of promise of manifest destiny and taking control of one's life is kind of shown to be, you know, crock of shit.
And that sort of fits into what I thought of, is that he is this representation in a lot of ways, that he played by their rules, that he continued to play by their rules all the time. He was a cop, he was a soldier, he was all these things, and that didn't fulfill him. And now he's out on the road, and it's like they're trying to stop him from the thing that he finds fulfilling in some way. And And then this could also go down to the concept of sort of how I feel about, once again, going to the Western, although this is one of those films that kind of bridges that era of the Western with, like, the Wild Bunch when it comes to the ending, you know, in that, you know, it's sort of like we're going to do it our way and we're going to go out in a blaze. If that's what it needs to be done, then that's what we're going to do. That sort of, so be it.
You know, the other thing that, going back to the original screenplay, that was most starkly different is that it's not a Dodge Challenger in the screenplay. It's a Ford Galaxy. So, you know, you can read into it all kinds of things as far as the Galaxy and him kind of in his own little, you know, universe as it is. But I like that it's a Dodge Challenger and that he's going to, you know, obviously bucking the system. He's challenging the system. And also, it's a much more bitchin' car and it just looks great as it's tearing through the desert. So I would be very curious to find out what the original kind of car was. This whole thing was based on a short story by Malcolm Hart, and unfortunately Mr. Hart doesn't seem to have the original short story at the ready anymore. It would be nice if that was actually kind of, you know, it would have been cool if it had been published as like liner notes with the, you know, the DVD release or something, but maybe one of these days. But luckily we had a chance to talk to Mr. Hart a few months ago, so we're going to go ahead and roll that interview and come back and talk about Vanishing Point some more.
Hello, this is George Lucas.
And I'm Batman.
And you're about to consume the Projection Booth podcast. We wanted to come in. We've been...
I like Mike White.
Really?
He's nice. And he finds stuff.
He is a nice boy. I used to let him...
He's like a detective. Just like those bad movie podcast guys.
Oh, yes. We were actually asked to represent that on this. We occasionally appear...
Those guys suffer. They suffer like I do.
Oh, it's great pain.
They go through bad movies, kind of like when I fight the Joker.
Yeah.
And he punches me in the face.
Yeah. So you can find that at badmoviepodcast.com.
Do you know why?
Why would that be?
Because I'm Batman.
You know, Batman, I actually know your secret identity.
No, you don't.
Yes, I do. It's Bruce Wayne. Bruce Wayne. Do you know how I know?
No.
I Googled it.
Oh, shit.
I'm the Googler.
No. No.
Yeah, no. Actually, I'm just George Lucas. But that would be it.
You are the editor.
Yeah, I'm the editator. I'll fix that in post.
Badmoviepodcast.com.
Hi, my name is Shane.
And I'm Monica.
And we are the two people.
We can't say anything.
Oh,
because they're going to censor us.
Is that the thing we signed?
Yeah.
We can't
say anything.
No bad words. No. So we can't tell them about our show.
No.
We can't actually tell them anything about what we do.
No.
Wow, that's really weird. Okay, well, hi, I'm Shane.
I'm Monica.
And
rantmehard.com.
That's all. Rantmehard.com. Go there and find out because we can't.
I can't believe we signed that thing.
We interrupt your podcastual programming for this HollywoodLeak.com news break. Here's the latest from HollywoodLeak.com. OWN network tanking. Oprah wants her cars back. CEO grows mustache. Changes his name to Walrus. And a quick pilot casting update. You didn't get it. Entertainment news is always leaking. For these stories and more, go to HollywoodLeak.com.
Tell me about your involvement with Vanishing Point. I see that you've got a story credit on there. What does that exactly mean?
I wrote the story, which was more or less stuck to, but my story didn't include any of these character building incidents. It was a two-page outline. You know, I spent a lot of time in America. In fact, in 1963, I emigrated there. I was a photographer, fashion photographer. I lived in New York for 4 years. And when I came back to England, you know, it was a strange period of history, as you guys all know, even if you didn't experience it. There was a lot of kind of self-knowledge and all that sort of thing going on. People were interested in spirituality, I guess you would call it. probably due to large quantities of marijuana being smoked. And Tim Leary was campaigning in those days, Turn On, Tune In, Drop Out. That was where I was, I guess I was in my mid-30s. That's where my head was at. I was a photographer, came back to England and met with people who had similar interests. And I was with a friend one evening. We were having, you know, just a social evening at his house. And it was the day that news came down the grapevine that Neil Cassady had died. Now, Neil Cassady was Jack Kerouac's driver. He was Moriarty in On the Road. And neither of us knew him. We had an affection for his lifestyle, the way he lived. I don't know if you know anything about him, but he was a very free spirit. And he was a driver. I mean, the 20th century was the century of the automobile. And Neil Cassady was the archetypical American driver. His machine was a seamless extension of his consciousness. He was that kind of driver. And he was dead. He was found on some railway spur in Mexico, dead of drugs and exhaustion, aged 40-something. Anyway, we were commiserating about this, the demise of one of the beat heroes, and we started remembering all sorts of other car stories, road stories and things like that. And my friend, who'd also lived in America for a long time, told me that one day he read in the San Francisco Chronicle, I think it was, there was a tiny column of an incident in which the police had chased a car, had flagged him down, and he didn't stop. I think he had a broken taillight, something like that, and he didn't stop. He sped on, and the police chased him, and there was a hell of a chase, and in the end, the guy got run off the road and killed. And that was it. That was the story. But to me, it was an amazing... suddenly, it was like a... it was an epic story. It was a bid for freedom. It was, I mean, the guy wasn't a felon. He had no record or anything. He was just a guy who liked driving fast, just like the cops liked driving fast. And there was this incident. And the kind of inevitability of the whole thing struck me as a story. It was rather like a Greek tragedy. Fate foretold, you know. In right. fact, when I wrote the actual two pages that I wrote, I titled it Pick a Card, Any Card. And in fact, built into the story was the idea that Kowalski, the main character, was making a living ferrying cars from Denver to San Francisco. And when he got into the garage in San Francisco, and in fact, they did keep this in the film. He was raring to go back again. He was a driver. This was Neil, you know. What have you got for me? And the guy in the delivery place fans out card dockets like a fan of cards. And he says, pick a card, any card. And that was Kowalski's fate. He picked this souped-up, doobly-doob card. And he couldn't, when he saw it, he was euphoric. You know, he has got this great beast to take back to California.
So once you wrote that, I mean, were you a writer by trade? Or, I mean, because you're a photographer.
I was a photographer, actually.
Right.
Yeah. And I never did, in looking back, I mean, I didn't really sort of think about these things in those days. I just did what came to mind, you know. Being a freelance photographer is pretty loose kind of existence. And in New York, a very remunerative one. I made a lot of money as a photographer. Mm-hmm. But... you know, I've been watching movies since I was 7. So movies, the idea, the medium as for any kind of creative expression was always there. And so to actually think of a story and see it as a movie wasn't too difficult. You know, I showed that to two people, these two typewritten pages. I showed it to two people. One was John Frankenheimer's representative in London. I don't know how I got an interest. I wasn't in the business, you know. I was a photographer. The other guy was a man called Ian Quarrier, who was actually an actor rather an actor who chose to act in unusual, new ideas and that. And he became a friend, and we used to smoke a joint together occasionally. And then he got involved in a production house. And when I finished the story, it was natural for me to show it to him. Well, both these people wanted it. Now, I don't know how many times in the history of filmmaking that's ever happened. You show two pieces of paper to two people, and they both want to give you money for it. But I chose my friend. It was an English company. Actually, I mean, when I saw they showed me the film when they made it, and I was rather disappointed, you know, the way it had been. What was a very tight, serious kind of story had mm-hmm. been Hollywoodized. And I'm no doubt that it's Hollywoodization that brought it its success. I don't think it would have done so. And I think maybe Frankenheimer might have made a film nearer to my feelings for the thing, but that's the way it goes. But I didn't pursue that in terms of a career. I mean, I thought, well, that's really nice. And what I did, my instinct, was to use the front money to make my own film. And I never really became involved in the Hollywood ethos. Even today, I have written Hollywood scripts and things like that over the years and worked in the industry briefly. But I was not a Hollywood person. I would have hesitated to say it then, but I was an artist. And I had ideas that I wanted to create myself. I didn't want to have teams of hundreds of people and producers and financiers and things like that. And in fact, the very first film I made, which was a 15-minute wonder movie, but it was made on film, 16 mil, and I had a great partner, and we made this typical 60s movie, in the sense that it was never scripted, it was shot totally intuitively, and at the end of the day, we were stunned by this entity we created, where strangers applauded.
Nice.
Not just friends. and we took it to... in fact, it sold. It sold 35 mil rights in Sweden and Canada. It got a prize in Yugoslavia. But I was not on a road to success. That wasn't the direction I was looking in, which really has colored the whole of my professional life. I've had, in my whole life, I've only had four good ideas. Vanishing Point was one of them. I mean, when I say good ideas, a good movie should take you somewhere you haven't been before. I've had three other ideas, two of which were even optioned at some point in time, you know, but never made the screen.
What were some of the differences between what you wrote and what ended up on screen? I mean, you said that there wasn't the character building and all that. Was there the radio DJ,
No, he was me. Yeah, he was my invention. Yeah, okay. The whole triangle. I mean, it was a good story. I have to say, even now, it was so structured. It was a triangular structure. There was the driver, the cops, and the DJ. And at a point fairly early on in the film, they link up on the radio. That was the strength of the film. And what they'd done that I hadn't, of course, because in two pages you don't, is when they wrote the script, they saw the need to develop. You can't have a film about a guy in a car, you know. Well, you can, but... So they saw the need to bring in incidents which would also develop the character of the main man, tell you a bit about him and so on. And I just thought that they were all very trite. I thought they were all corny little incidents, you know. That's what disappointed me, really. I was very happy when the check started rolling.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I bet. Your friend took the story, had his own production company. Were you involved after that, or did it just kind of leave your hands?
Hardly at all.
Okay.
I was at a couple of meetings early on, and then I got on with my life. I forget what. Oh, that was. I'll write a book sometime, send it to you.
Vanishing Point seems like such a American story, you know, those wide open places and everything. Had you visited the West, or had you just seen it through movies?
No. I emigrated. I lived in New York. My home was in New York for 4 years.
Right.
And during that time, I traveled around a bit, sure. Yeah, I was also fascinated by the social changes taking place. I'm 80 years old now. I was brought up with Victorian values. So when I came to New York in my early, I'd had previously had a career in advertising. I'd done advertising. I'd been the creative director of a London advertising agency on the board, and then I became a photographer. I felt I'd done advertising. In fact, it was beginning to be boring. And then with the advent of Vanishing Point, there was money, and I could do more or less what I wanted. And in fact, with Vanishing Point money, I did tuck myself away in the countryside and write.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah.
Well, it's got to be quite a boost to your ego when one of the first things you write becomes this movie, and you know, you get that the interest in the two parties. That's great.
It is, you know. But just speaking for my own personal experience, great things happened to me in those first parts of my life. I really didn't have any specific ambition. I just kind of, I guess I went with the flow, as they say. And the flow took me into all those interesting things. And the flow took me out of still photography into the moving image, you know. I was very conscious, actually, having been a photographer by that time for about 10 years, earning a good living. I wasn't nothing to grumble about, and not bad. You know, it's nice being a photographer. But there was a sense that when you're looking through the SLR, I started to feel that I wanted to know what came before and what happened after, rather than just freezing that moment, you know, with the... I guess that there was definitely a consciousness of that. I wanted to explore movies. And so that first one I did was a total exploration. It was a consummate artistic experience, you could say. It had no commercial ambitions or anything. It was just done for the sake of doing it.
Kowalski, I find him very fascinating because he is, well, he's kind of enigmatic, and you can kind of project onto him what you want to project onto him. Did you see any of yourself in him when you wrote him, or did you have any more of his backstory in mind, or was he supposed to be that kind of cipher for the reader, for the audience?
There was a cop in my life. I had a mate that I met when I lived in New York who used to be a cop, and that was still part of his social persona, you know. We would hear all the stories and everything like that. And he was a beautiful guy. I guess there would be something of him in it. And I would have consulted with him about it, actually. Whenever there are any cops in my stories, I would consult with him. Well, I've forgotten what was the action? What did you ask about? Anything of me?
Right.
Well, of course, there's always something, be it aspirational or, you know, be it the way one might like to be or something, I don't know. But I'll tell you an interesting thing before I forget it. I've had odd emails from various people, mostly young people, about the film. And one person wrote and asked, were there two endings? Because one person swore that after the car crashed, there was footage which continued the car went on in some way. Like the spirit of Kowalski lives. It was like... But they actually invented... There weren't two versions. There was only the one version when he decides to explore death. My family are still very proud that Dad wrote my grandchildren.
They should be proud. It's great. It's a great film.
You know, I was in New York and I saw that guy, a great actor who played the black guy.
Cleavon Little.
Cleavon Little. He was in a show on Broadway. I can't remember what it was. Anyway, I went to see it and I sent a note back to him. And we met afterwards. And I was always curious about his dialogue, his rap. And I thought, well, maybe this is the actor being given a, you know, say, okay, let's have it. But he said, no, it was written. That whole line was written, and it was written by Guillermo Kane. Yeah, Guillermo Kane was a Cuban, actually. He used to be the Cuban ambassador to Paris. But Guillermo wrote that rap, and I thought that was amazing. I thought for sure that it was Cleveland Little letting go. But no, that was good. I liked Cleveland. I wasn't thrilled by the guy who played Kowalski, Barry Newman. No. In fact, you know, subsequently I met people. I met Peter Fonda when I lived in Hollywood for it. And I had a moment's fame, having been the original story. Peter Fonda desperately wanted to do it. Apparently there was the distribution deal with 20th Century. Daryl Zanuck made it Newman was his protege, and Daryl Zanuck insisted that he give him the film.
I had heard rumors that the director wanted Gene Hackman for a while.
What, to play that role?
Yeah, to play Kowalski.
I thought the director was very good. I'd never met him or anything. I had a chance to talk to him, but I thought he directed it. And, of course, photography was very good. No, there was a lot good about the film. It was just my own personal disappointment that it was popularized for very good reason, you know, those little incidents we talked about before. Thought they could have been more interesting. I don't take exception with the idea of the incidents. It's just that the actual incidents themselves were, the writing was banal. You know, it was bad, it was corny, it was, I think they could have gotten away with something just a bit more original in these incidents too. But
right.
They didn't. They went for exactly, you know what I mean? He's this kind of guy, he's that kind of guy, he does this, he does that, you know. That's what I did want to say about Vanishing Point, was that because of the times in which it was written, and written by somebody who was involved with those times, I think that's what resonated in, that's why it got good audiences, and why it actually does deal with certain universal feelings, of quite deep feelings, really, about death and general behavior, freedom, and so on. And I think that it was somehow, as was Easy Rider, that had the same thing in a different way. It was voicing the feelings of the time for a lot of people that you wouldn't be able to articulate it necessarily, but it just, they said, yeah.
Back. It's a little bit of a song called Thighs of a Czar by Modern Silence Cinema, which is rumored to be the name of one of our guest co-host one-man band. So, Cullen, any credence to that rumor there, sir?
Unfortunately, yes, I'm caught. That is my project at the moment when I'm at home in front of the computer with my guitar.
Sounds good. Well, getting back into the discussion, we've alluded to earlier Vanishing Point being one of those several road movies. Now, I know personally I'm a big fan of other road movies, chiefly like Death Race 2000. Vanishing Point is similar from the race point, A to B, some detours along the way. But how does this one sort of work for you when we sort of look at it as maybe in race films or car films or things like that, guys?
Colin brought up Two Lane Blacktop earlier, and I definitely see a lot of similarities. I want to say this one came before, but it really doesn't matter because it was just kind of tapping into the zeitgeist of, you know, we've got this highway system now and we've got these people who are still trying to be individuals in a country that seems to be kind of coming together as one major force, and people still want to be on their own. And there was nothing that could really quite express that as much, to me anyway, as jumping in their car, their own little castle, and heading out onto the road. And I think that's really what comes through with Vanishing Point and with Two Lane Blacktop, and then with some of the other road movies that were out at the time. I mean, Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry was another great one. And then you kind of get a little bit of a resurgence from time to time, you know, with things like, that classic cinematic gem called The Chase with Charlie Sheen and Christy Swanson. Now that was truly a transcendental road movie.
Oh, and Red Hot Chili Peppers were in that. Henry Rollins. I think I wanted a monster truck when I first saw that, but I was very young and one of my many foolish dreams based on movies.
And you get a lot of the same stuff that you get in Gone in 60 Seconds, the original gone in 60 seconds, this kind of one man against the world, against the cops, and racing along. And that has a much different feel and also plot than the quote-unquote remake that happened a few years ago. And I can safely say that the same thing happens when we get a remake of Vanishing Point. I think it was 1997, made-for-TV movie, with Viggo Mortensen as Kowalski and Steve Railsback as a cop after him, and the one and only The Voice being played by one of Rob's favorite actors. I'll let you talk about that one, Rob.
Oh, God, please. Vanishing Point remake. Oh, Vanishing Point remake. Okay, I'll walk you through the Vanishing Point remake. Okay, it opens with the bulldozer setup. But once again, as I said, you can't have 8 minutes of silence. So it moves a lot faster in the opening than the 1971 film. Okay, at least they have the Challenger again, which is good. You know, because by 1997... The cars that are being made, come on. You know, really? Are you going to do this? Are you going to do Vanishing Point in, like, I don't know, a Ford Focus? It's just not going to work. So they go back to the Dodge Challenger, which is nice. It's one of the more badass cars. Even today, they suck, because I'll tell you one of the reasons why. See, I'm going to get off of my, you know, my Detroit stripes are shown here. You know, they made the cars back then. They had huge engines, but there was one thing about those cars that they don't put on them today. And you want to know what it is?
What's that?
Tell me.
Chrome bumpers. Those massive chrome bumpers that you just it's awesome. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, I would go out. My dad had a 1970 Chevy Nova SS, and we would just polish that chrome bumper. It was a thing of beauty. They don't bother to put those on the cars anymore. So anyway, let me take the car hat off. So Viggo Mortensen, okay, in this thing. There's so many cliches in this movie. There's so much crap in this film that I want to point to two things that I think are beauty things, all right? Three things, okay. Viggo Mortensen, good to look at. He's doing okay. He's working with the stuff he's got. Steve Railsback, working with what he's got in front of him. He does a great job. Keith David, working with the stuff he's got. He could read the back of the cereal box, Keith David. And I love the guy. I think he's great. So, but the thing is, it's just all these cliches. And one of the first ones that pulled me out when I was watching this happens at about 10 minutes in, which is when the cops first pull him over. The cops are sitting there. They're motorcycle cops. One's drinking coffee. What does he do? Spit take with the coffee, throws his coffee down, and chases him on the bike.
Oh, God.
I'm like, really, man? Really? And then there's this whole thing where, okay, the use of the term, the last name, just Kowalski, okay, with Barry Newman in the original 1971 film, that leads to this whole thing about cop, military, the idea that he doesn't have a first name, much like Rambo, and when we talked about First Blood, it allows for a lot more projection because we don't know enough about him. Well, Viggo Mortensen's character, he's Jimmy or James Kowalski, okay, and we get all Jimmy. this whole background, and his wife pregnant and all this.
He's the guy at the counter at the diner near you now.
Yeah, exactly.
Jimmy Kowalski. He's a nice guy. He's from Chicago. You'd like him.
There you go. Or Hamtramck, since we're here in Detroit. So the whole thing is that he just wants to see his wife have that kid. He wants to see his wife have that kid. So there's the big thing. But of course, once again, we have elements from the first film. So he's a Gulf War vet. He's been fucked with by the cops. There's all these flashback things that they throw in there. There's this like Oliver Stone-esque Native American scene in there that reminded me of like Natural Born Killers, where it's like, you white man, let me show you the spiritualism of the natives, you know, because the natives always have to speak in this profound way. It's like it's the cliche of the natives, much the cliche of the East, you know, where it's like we're going to go talk to the ancient Chinese guy, you know, and he's going to solve all of our problems. And then Jason Priestley. Oh, my God. As the voice. This is horrible. He's in a trucker hat and he's got a mustache. It looks like some sort of Saturday Night Live character. It's just ridiculous. You know, you get to the end, and in the end of Vanishing Point, as we talked about, is this, once again, it's this looping thing. But of course, by 1997, we can't make a film that has a downer like that. We can't have a film where the hero kills themselves and we just roll the credits. No, we can't do that. We can't have people walking away from this. And this is on TV, so it's not like they're walking out of the theater. So what do? They put all this gobbledygook on top of it to make it seem like he's reached some sort of spiritual nirvana, or he's in heaven now, or he's with his wife, or there's all this stuff. It's just like, what the fuck, man?
It's estimated that the Challenger, riddled with more than 200 bullet holes, hit those bulldozers at over 185 miles an hour. No one could have survived that impact. But no body was ever found. So what happened to Kowalski? The authorities say he's dead, vaporized in the explosion. Some witnesses swear they saw him bail out and escape with the help of allies in the crowd. Still others claim that he and his daughter are now living somewhere out west. I don't know. But it's somehow reassuring that even in this computerized, bar-coded era of data banks and thumbprints, at least a few mysteries still remain.
Oh, God, this is painful.
You had brought up how, people watching the TV remake, they're not even leaving the theater. They're just at home. They can't be left on a downer. The ending of the original Vanishing Point, I think, very much references the audience watching this sort of spectacle. Because they show everyone standing by the side of the road. Some of them have cameras. They have food. You know, they're waiting for Kowalski to show up, and they're waiting for this big, you know, confrontation with the police. And frankly, most of them look bored out of their minds. They're like talking to each other. They kind of want to go home. And then as soon as the ending happens, that's kind of what happens. They get up. Some of them wander over and look. Some of them sort of go home, and they seem to have missed the point. They're almost like let down by the fact that Kowalski has like met his doom.
Which I think would be a nice statement, sort of, I guess, maybe on the idea of spectator in life. You know, that people seem to wait around and want to watch other people do things and want to sit around and watch sort of the thing play out in front of them, but they're not hip to, you know, strap up their boots and actually get in on the action themselves. They would rather just sit there and look bored with life as opposed to actually, you know, getting behind the wheel and taking it.
I think the ending of a Two Line Blacktop is similarly about the act of watching a movie, because the movie just kind of fucking dissolves and it just goes into oblivion, which is, you know, the same place where Vanishing Point goes. It's the Blaze of Glory, as y'all called it, that happens at the end of The Wild Bunch and Easy Rider. Zabriskie Point probably has the biggest blaze of glory of all these.
And I think philosophically, all of this also goes back to probably the first film that I can think of that of this era to have that sort of, you know, the heroes dying in the end and forcing the audience out into the streets after they've had to take it in is probably where all that starts, is Bonnie and Clyde. It's sort of a philosophical error. You know, everything sort of comes down the pipe from Bonnie and Clyde forward, you know, to have a film end like that. And to be honest, it's like that's not something that you see now in modern film. The studios are not hip to that. There's obviously independent film that's willing to do that. The only way that these endings work, like the original Vanishing Point works, is because you've locked the character in such a way that there is no other option, that the only way is through. And that's it. You know, if he were to dodge around the bulldozers and keep going, and then it's like 2 years later and he's sitting at a bar having a drink, he'd be like, what? You know, you would walk out of there going, I don't get it. What happened? You know, because the setup from the very beginning is this is where it stops. And the idea that the only way is through, I think, even if you die, is a profound statement in terms of, you know, philosophical existentialism, you know, and especially that era in which it was created, when we're talking about all the political upheaval, things like that, and people trying to find their space really as Vietnam was still going on.
The other thing that's interesting about the time period in which this was made is Hollywood was trying to figure out how to stay on top and how to make money, because you had sort of the rise of independent films in the 60s and a lot of the Roger Corman stuff that was raking in the dough and Easy Rider. And it seems like each of the studios tried to have sort of these artistic, you know, very contemporary, a little bit more artsy projects. Universal had the last movie, the Dennis Hopper thing, and that completely flopped. This was 20th Century Fox. I think Zabriskie Point was MGM. And I don't think these studios stuck with this for very long. As we were saying, Zanuck was kicked out of his own studio before Vanishing Point was even finished. None of these other movies were as successful financially as like Bonnie and Clyde or Easy Rider, I don't think.
One of the things with Vanishing Point is it seems to kind of pop up here and there, and a lot of times it's either a direct reference or people don't necessarily, I don't think most people who don't know the film would get the references. So there has been a few places where that's come up recently, Mike, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, well, you had mentioned at least two of them, because we've got Barry Newman in The Limey, and he's wearing the same sunglasses that he was wearing in Vanishing Point, which is great. I mean, Soderbergh knows the cinema, and he just brings these kind of very subtle touches to it. And then rather than being subtle, you kind of get a hammer to the head when it comes to the Challenger showing up again in Death Proof and that whole conversation.
To me, there's no point in being in America unless you can drive a Detroit muscle car. And I want to drive a Dodge Challenger. Fuck me swinging balls out.
Well, I guess we can talk to Transpo, but does it have to be a Dodge Challenger?
Not just that. It has to be a 1970 Dodge Challenger with a 440 engine. A 1970 Dodge Challenger with a white paint job.
Oh, Kowalski.
Kowalski from Vanishing Point. Mate, it's a fucking classic. If I can get this guy to let me drive it without him, I will blow the doors off that bitch.
What's Vanishing Point?
What's Vanishing Point? Abs, I'm supposed to be the literate one. It's just one of the best American movies ever made.
Actually, Zoe, most girls wouldn't know Vanishing Point.
Excuse me? Most girls? What the fuck are you two?
Yeah, well, we're gearheads. Of course, we watched it.
Y'all grew up watching that Pretty in Pink shit.
Oh, I like Pretty in Pink.
What? So you didn't watch John Hughes movies?
Of course I did. I'm a girl. But I also watched car shit, too. Vanishing Point, Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry, Gone in 60 Seconds. The real one? Not that Angelina Jolie bullshit.
We have an outdoor theater in Auckland. Plays Vanishing Point. Big Wednesday. All the classics.
And as I'm watching that conversation, I'm just like, man, I would rather be watching any of these movies than watching this movie that I'm suffering through right now. And then probably the most direct reference that we get is Mark Romanek, the director of Static that we talked about a few months ago. He actually did a whole homage to The Vanishing Point when it came to Audioslave's video for Show Me How to Live, and down to having Super Soul at the beginning and introducing everything and then kind of integrating the band into The Vanishing Point movie itself, which was really kind of cool. Colin, please go ahead and tell us a little bit about this modern silent cinema thing that you do and Pulp Serenade.
All right. Well, modern silent cinema started in 2004. I just moved and left the band I was in at the time, and I needed something just to keep playing. So I started recording really, really crappy chord progressions on my guitar and just playing bass along for practice. And I came up with the name in about 3 seconds because I was importing it into iTunes and they make you put a band name. I think I had foolish intentions of someday scoring silent films, which has never really happened, except for some YouTube stuff for fun. It just kind of wound up being like sort of my steady music project. And I record all the instruments. I'm working on a overly ambitious project now that needs to be toned down. It's called Since Man Left the Caves, and hopefully that'll be done sometime this fall.
Well, you don't need to leave the cave in order to get more of your stuff. Is there a website or other place where people can find out more?
It's modernsilentcinema.bandcamp.com. You can stream everything for free and listen to it. And my other thing that Mike mentioned, Pulp Serenade, is just my blog, pulpserenade.com, which has been inactive as of late, but I have plans to get it up and running now that I've moved and have successfully unpacked all my books. But it's mainly just a place to write about classic contemporary crime fiction and westerns. And there's a specific focus on western noir. And hopefully going to be doing a lot of writing about those this summer.
Sounds great. Well, once again, projection-booth.com, the place to go. You can learn out more. We'll have all the links for Cullen's various enterprises and sundry ideas. Once again, gents, that brings us to the end of another episode of the Projection Booth. I think I see those bulldozers up ahead.
Let's pop the clutch and tell the cops to eat our dust.